Good evening. It's 6 minutes after 7 o'clock. This is the evening edition of Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. I'll be joined by my colleagues Antoinette Grajeda and Christina Thomas in just a few minutes. This quick reminder before we get further into the show, this is the KUAF Spring Fundraiser. The phone volunteers have gone home for the evening. We'll have a new set back at 6 tomorrow morning, but you can still make a pledge. Perhaps you've been hearing us discuss the Spring Fundraiser and why it's so important, because we need you to help pay for the programs. You've been hearing this for the past couple of days, and you haven't had a chance to contribute. You can do so right now online. Just go to supportkuaf.com, supportkuaf.com, and all the questions you may have about making a contribution will be answered there. You determine the amount and you determine the method, and you can do that right now, safe and secure. The reason we have a spring fundraiser is because programs like Fresh Air and Performance Today, and yes, Ozarks at Large, cost money to produce. If you rely on those programs to hear interesting conversations, great classical music, or find out what's going on in your region, please know that the public radio experience that you have fully depends on listener contributions. Listeners like you who decide on a financial contribution and then make one. Again, right now, you can go online to supportkuaf.com, make a financial contribution in the amount you choose. And later on this edition of Ozarks at Large, the General Assembly has entered its 12th week at the state capitol. Roby Rock will talk to a pair of political observers about what's left for lawmakers, and there's plenty, and how the GOP has handled its majority in both chambers.
But first, the Arkansas House of Representatives yesterday completed an override of Governor Mike Beebe's veto of a bill that requires voters in the state to show a photo ID before casting a vote. The House voted 52-45 for the override. The governor says the bill is a solution looking for a problem. Stephen Meeks, a Republican representative from Greenbrier, spoke for the override, saying the bill is a needed protection.
We are trying to protect the integrity of one of the most fundamental rights that we have here in America. And as a matter of fact, when I talk to citizens across the state, they tell me time and time again that this is a common sense solution. Why aren't they doing this? It doesn't make sense.
Representative John Walker, a Democrat from Little Rock, spoke against the override, taking issue with Meeks's and others' assertions that the bill protects rights.
But there is no justification that he has for the belief that there is voter fraud in Arkansas or any place else that's of a substantive nature, anything more than a token number of people who may not properly respect the exercise of the vote.
Supporters of the bill have referred to former Democratic Representative Hudson Hallam's guilty plea to voter fraud for destroying absentee ballots as an indication for the bill's need. Opponents claim that a voter ID requirement wouldn't have stopped that instance of fraud, and that the requirement will negatively affect the voter turnout of poor, older, and minority voters.
Arkansas House Majority Leader Bruce Westerman says lawmakers can get a better idea of the viability of expanding health insurance for a 250,000 Arkansans if they wait another year while they gather more information. Westerman, a Republican from Hot Springs, told reporters yesterday that lawmakers could pass a bill enabling the expansion, but scheduling it to begin in July of 2014 rather than January of that same year.
And I know the first argument against that is, well, you're going to lose 6 months of the free money from the federal government for health care. But I would rather us develop a sound program that everybody can understand and support than just to make a rash decision here in 2 weeks and lose total control of what's going to happen.
Representative Westerman says the state might be able to negotiate for a later start date for insurance expansion, but Governor Mike Beebe says it's a bad idea because the federal government is unlikely to let the state opt in after the currently specified Medicaid expansion date.
You know, that's in the law. Congress passed that law. You can't negotiate with the federal government to give us money that that they said they'd give us under Medicaid expansion, but you can't say, oh, give us the money anyway, we're not going to do Medicaid expansion. Use your common sense.
Representative Westerman's plan would push back the state's appropriation of federal money for insurance coverage of the state's population earning up to 138% of the federal poverty level until the 2014 fiscal legislative session.
Though it may be days before some Faulkner County residents can return to their homes after this weekend's oil spill in Mayflower, a group in Pope County is busy cleaning animals caught in the wake of the thousands of barrels of crude oil that gushed out of a ruptured Exxon pipeline. Lynn Slater is the founder and executive director of the Hawk Center. Hawk stands for Helping Arkansas's Wild Critters. And Slater says the Russellville-based organization is one of nine animal rehabilitation centers in the state. The center has rehabilitated about a dozen sludge-soaked ducks so far.
Now, I do know that Exxon is bringing in an expert oil response, wildlife oil response team from Texas that has a mobile unit, and they will be setting up a mobile command washing center only 20 minutes away from the site. So they will be responding to all the oiled animals, and then we will get them for longer-term rehabilitation.
For example, long-term rehabilitation of ducks involves caring for the birds after they are cleaned and until they have regained their natural waterproofing. Although the Hawk Center could use more hazmat-trained volunteers, cleaning the endangered animals is not a task for the public at large.
Well, Joe Public should not be handling these animals at all. There are way too many risks for somebody who's not trained to expose themselves to the hazards. This is hazmat material. They should be wearing protective equipment, safety goggles, aprons, big vinyl gloves. It's nasty stuff. You have to wear masks and not breathe in the fumes. It's really awful.
But Slater says the general public can make other contributions, as the group has posted a wish list of items it needs to continue cleaning and rehabilitating animals soiled by the sludge. Just go to hawkcenter.org for more information.
90% chance of more rain tonight, lows from the mid to upper 30s throughout the region. 70% chance of rain tomorrow, highs in the mid to upper 40s. And for Wednesday night, 70% chance of rain, lows from the upper 30s to lower 40s. This is Ozarks at Large for Tuesday, April 2nd, broadcasting from the Carver Center for Public Radio. Senators and representatives at the state capitol have 11 weeks of legislating behind them, but the fate of Medicaid's future, possible tax policy, and more are still to come. This weekend, Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas talked to two political bloggers about the session, Michael Cook, who blogs mainly from the left at Cook's Outlook, and Jason Tolbert, who writes generally from the right at Tolbert's Report. Roby asked them if it seemed like nerves were beginning to become worn 3 months into the session.
Yeah, you know, I describe it as day six of a week-long vacation in a one-bedroom condo with an extended family. Everybody's just kind of starting to get on each other's nerves.
Yeah, they're ready to go home, and Arkansans are ready for them to go home.
Yeah.
So everybody wants them to go home.
True.
I talked to a GOP insider this week, somebody who, a high-ranking Republican official, not elected, but very active in party politics. We ran into each other at lunch. He told me, this governance stuff's kind of hard. You know, we've got to actually, it's been easy to lob grenades and be the minority party. We've got to figure some of this stuff out. It's kind of tough. Jason, I guess my first question to you is, how do you rate the GOP's handling of leadership in its first time in 138 years?
Sure. Well, I would say it's yet to be determined. We're really going to have to look back at the session after it's over and see if they got everything done. I think things are moving in the right direction right now. I think, you know, we're starting to see some movements on some of the tax cuts. We're not sure exactly which ones are going to move out, but it's pretty certain those are going to move through in some form or fashion. We're seeing that the what's going to happen with the health care come together. It looks like that's starting to kind of gel, starting to solidify. So if they can make all these things come together at the end, or at the end of the session, they can stand up and they can say, we did what we promised we would do, we did what we campaigned on, and these are our accomplishments, then I would say they did it. They succeeded. But it's yet to be determined if they can get across that finish line. They're on about the 20th mile of a 26-mile marathon.
Michael, your take.
They're struggling still. We spent the first 8 to 10 weeks of the session talking about guns and abortion, or abortion and guns, and now finally they're starting to talk about real things that matter in terms of tax cuts and creating jobs and the Medicaid expansion. What's also funny is that these Republicans, in a lot of ways, have to look to Democrats to run the government. Governor Beebe being a prime example, because you know he knows how to run both the legislative branch and the executive branch. So you know I would agree with Jason that it's still, we'll see at the end of the session what their scorecard could be, but right now they're still struggling.
Well, and I have to say that I don't think there's any big surprises here. I think we knew there would be a transition period where Democrats would struggle being in the minority, right, and Republicans would struggle being in the majority. All right, major development this week involving health insurance expansion. Obviously, the feds have given Arkansas permission to take their Medicaid expansion money, shift it into subsidizing these low-income health insurance plans that are going to come through the health insurance exchanges. Representative Bruce Westerman, the majority leader, tweets this on Thursday. Numbers are in. Private option, best health care scenario for Arkansas budget. Not so good for feds who caused problem in first place. And then in another tweet, he says, no is still an option. We now know better what no means. More cost to state, less cost to feds. In essence, Representative Westerman, who resides with the Tea Party part of his caucus quite often, is giving a blessing to this private option that some members of the Tea Party caucus oppose. Does that help get this vote to the supermajority it's going to need for the appropriation to pass this health insurance expansion? Is it there?
I think it's very close. The state legislatures I spoke with this week were kind of mixed on it. Some of them were predicting it would pass. Some of them predicting it may have to go to a special session before they get it really gels together to pass. But it's much closer than I think anyone would have estimated it'd be at a month ago. And you know, I wrote a column this week on the fact that what we're really seeing is Republicans and Democrats work together on actually coming up with a solution that works. And really, I mean, I think the folks in Washington, D.C. could take a tip from folks here in Arkansas that they're actually moving together to give a little bit here and give a little bit there and compromise and bring something that'll work better for the state. So if they pull this off, if they're able to make these reforms and put these different things in place that will actually make the Medicaid system work more efficiently and actually get this thing passed with 75 votes, it will really be, I think, almost a miracle that they actually got it done.
Democrats seem to be okay with it, although I don't think it's their first choice.
Not their first choice, but the, you know, it's like a snowball rolling downhill. It gets bigger and bigger and more momentum. I think this is what we're seeing in this case as it pertains to the Medicaid private option. You know, it's been shown that this is going to be cheaper for Arkansas. It's going to help these poor, working poor Arkansans, and it sounds like a great deal all around. You know, all we need is 75 votes, and there's some people who probably have to vote against it because no matter what, they're
right
against any form of
they
Obamacare.
They opposed Obamacare,
but,
right.
But once they start seeing that, you know, the Chamber of Commerce, other folks coming on board saying this is the right thing to do and it saves us money, you know, how could you vote against it?
Governor Beebe and leadership in the legislature says this is going to be tied to tax cuts. So let's turn our attention to tax cuts. The House GOP is supporting a capital gains tax cut and some income tax bracket reform led by Representative Charlie Collins. House Democrats support a different income tax bracket reform. In the Senate, you've got the GOP and the Democrats almost unified on some targeted business and agriculture tax cuts. And then you still have Governor Beebe's triggered grocery tax proposal out there. There's no way to do all of these tax cuts. Mm-hmm. And really, I would say that by the end of this week, I determined that there is just a huge impasse. They're at loggerheads over whether it's governor versus legislature, House versus Senate. Someone's going to have to lose. Who of that group I just mentioned has the best chance of losing their tax break?
I think it's too early to tell. I think, you know, everybody has, there's different competing interests. Democrats have one bill, Republicans have a couple other bills. I think you're right. There's so much back and forth, you know, who wants what and so on and so forth. The biggest thing, what's interesting is that, you know, historically in Arkansas, Democrats have sort of railed against tax cuts that have targeted the wealthy and benefited them. This time in this session so far, now things may change quickly, but so far they have not really railed against some of these bills that have just basically benefited sort of the wealthy Arkansans. It'll be curious to see if Democrats really grab that banner back of economic populism or if they're going to let Republicans take a hold of it.
Jason, what do you think? Who's most apt to lose in this tax cut war?
Well, I think it's going to come down to the showdown we usually see around this time of the session, Senate versus the House. You know, now I think Governor Beebe has really almost kind of staked out a position that ties his grocery tax cut to certain economic triggers in the budget. I think that's probably where his tax cut will end up. Mm-hmm. So his may be more contingent on how the budget comes in, whether that one goes into effect or not. The House versus the Senate seems like it's usually one of these deals where, you know, the House will dig in their heels, the Senate will dig in their heels, and then finally, we've got to get it passed. It's almost over, and both of them kind of get half of what they want. So I think you'll see some bracket reform in the income tax cut that Charlie Collins has been pushing. I think you'll see some targeted business tax cuts that the Senate seems to like. And then I think Speaker Carter will probably get at least some form of capital gains cut. How that slices out, it's going to be interesting to see. Those percentages could move some in his proposal to change the financial impact.
Yeah, it goes from 30% exempt to 70% in the latest proposal. Here's something I've heard of interest on the income tax bracket reform, and this relates to either the Democratic proposal or Charlie Collins' proposal, which represents the Republican position, is that because income tax is such a big piece of the pie, to make the incremental reform that they're making, which is not huge, I mean, it's going from 7% to 6 7/8, it's almost a glorified grocery tax. Mm-hmm. Taxpayers are not going to feel it. Does that potential exist out there? You pass income tax reform, and nobody knows that you passed income tax reform.
Well, you know, I wonder if it's one of those things where, in some ways, if we have our priorities a little bit off, and that, you know, you made a good point in terms of you gave a tax cut but nobody notices. You know, a few weeks back we cut the lottery scholarships because it was running out of money. You know, I'm curious to know why we aren't investing further into higher education. You know, why this rush to give tax cuts to people who may not even notice it, when on the other hand we have an opportunity to invest in the future. I mean, it's one thing that's kind of frustrating that nobody's really is talking about it enough in terms of why aren't we thinking long term instead of a tax cut that nobody might not even know they get.
Yeah, Jason, what's your take on that?
Well, you know, when you look at the proposal from Representative Collins, the thing that I see, the bracket reform, moving those brackets to a higher amount before you kick into the highest marginal tax rate.
$34,000 to $44,000.
Right, that's going to affect the most number of Arkansans. A lot of middle income families will see some real relief from that proposal. So I think that has the best chance of surviving. You mentioned just, I think it's the 1/8 percentage that comes off the highest bracket. That's the biggest impact to the budget. And so I think that might be in the most precarious position. But when you look at the number of middle income Arkansans that would be affected by that bracket movement, I think that really has some headway to get through.
Yes or no, with just a little bit of editorial in here, Big River Steel Super Project, does it get done? It seems to have been a little dicey earlier in the week. I think that its position has strengthened by week's end. Does it get there?
I think it gets done. I mean, there's some people who have concerns about, are we giving, you know, is this the free market and giving you know, government money to corporations? But at the end of the day, it looks like it will help a region and an area that really needs some real economic development. I think at the end of the day, it'll pass.
Jason?
Yeah, I think so too. You know, I think there has been some concerns expressed that made the numbers that came from the Department of Economic Development look not quite as rosy as they looked at first. But the train's gone so far down the tracks, it's really difficult to pull it back at this point. I think it would be hard to turn that ship around this late in the game. But
who wants to be on record as voting against jobs?
Sure.
You know, the average voter has no clue in terms of all the dynamics of it all, but it seems like it's a jobs proposal, and who wants to be on record as voting against jobs?
Roby Brock talked to bloggers Jason Tolbert and Michael Cook before the 12th week of the General Assembly began this week. Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from 4 offices in Arkansas, Texas, in New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com.
And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at BankOzarks.com. And the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity. More at AECC.com. It's 25 and a half minutes after 7. This is the Tuesday evening edition of Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me from time to time tonight, Antoinette Grajeda and Christina Thomas. Last week, I had a conversation with the writer Leonard Molyneux. His previous best-selling book was The Drunkard's Walk. His latest is titled Subliminal: How Your Unconscious Mind Rules Your Behavior. In a couple of weeks on Ozarks, a longer conversation with him. But I wanted to let you hear part of our conversation. Toward the tail end of our discussion, I asked him about public radio and something you're probably very familiar with right now, public radio fundraisers. We're a public radio station, and as you probably know, public radio stations every couple times a year engage in fundraisers, on-air fundraisers. Is there research that public radio could conduct to, you know, make that listener give or give a bit more?
Oh, there certainly is, and there's a whole field called neuromarketing now that's arisen in the last just 10 years, which is taking what neuroscientists are learning about your unconscious and applying it to advertising and marketing and sales of all sorts. How to phrase things, how to make things look, different ways that you make your pitch can have a huge difference on what people do. There's a very interesting study, for instance, about public signage, where we're trying to stop someone from doing something like littering. And they've actually done experiments in the national parks. If you put a sign up that says, don't litter, 25 tons of litter come on this forest every year that we have to clean up. That sounds like you're making a good argument not to litter. But people will actually litter more than if you just say, don't litter, or don't litter, it's bad for the environment, or something else. But the fact that the first sign that I mentioned says that other people do it is an unconscious cue that it's actually okay to do. And that apparently overrides the explanatory power of saying that as a reason not to do it. So when they put up signs that varied, some of them said everyone does it and it makes a big burden on society, versus putting up other messages that don't say that everyone did it, they found that the signs that say everyone does it are far less effective.
So
this field of neuromarketing gives people who are trying to sell many, many tips, you know, for better or for worse, about how to convince us of things.
So when sometimes at some public radio stations they say, you know, you've got to give because X percentage of our listenership doesn't give, that may actually
be bad. If a public radio station says, oh, poor us, you're all out there listening and 95% of you don't support the station. That's really saying, it's ironic, but it's really saying it's okay not to support the station. The social norm is don't support the station. And social norms are very important to people, whether you realize it or not, on an unconscious level. So that is a bad message.
So just say, if you like what you hear, give. Does that work?
If you like what you hear, give. I suppose making people feel guilty, like don't listen and not pay. Would you take the New York Times or they are, you know, any other newspaper from a vendor without paying, you'd probably feel bad about that. You know, if he was looking away, would you grab one and walk away if you could get away with it? You probably wouldn't. You'd feel bad. Well, if you're listening to us and we're important to you, then please support us and help us bring you this, because it's the right thing to do. And because if you don't, we won't be here tomorrow. That's a good message. But to say, don't be like everyone else and not support us, that doesn't work. That's really saying to someone, hey, it's not so bad not to support us. Look at everyone else. They don't do it either.
And here we are still. We've been able to survive without that.
Exactly. And I'm telling you, there's very interesting studies where they did that with signage, and it makes a huge difference. So, that's pretty well established.
The name of the book is Subliminal: How Your Unconscious Mind Rules Your Behavior. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. It's been fun, and I hope your listeners support you.
Thank you. The writer Leonard Molyneux, the book is Subliminal: How Your Unconscious Mind Rules Your Behavior. We were talking about how you convince people to do something, and we will have a longer conversation about the subconscious mind with Leonard Molyneux in a couple of weeks on Ozarks at Large. Oh, by the way, if you like what you hear on this radio station and you've come to appreciate what you hear, Fresh Air, All Things Considered, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Classical Music Through the Night, please remember, all of those things cost money. And as he pointed out, if you like it and you wouldn't take the New York Times or the Arkansas Democrat Gazette or one of the other newspapers you read, if you wouldn't take that without paying, please remember, it's contributions from listeners just like you that help pay for the programs you listen to on KUAF. Now, while we don't have any phone volunteers here with us at this hour, we do have a website that accepts your financial contribution around the clock. You can go to supportkuaf.com and make a contribution. You choose the amount. You can decide whether you like to do it in one lump sum, or maybe it's $10 a month to make a $120 contribution. That decision, totally up to you. But if you'd like to make a contribution, you can do it right now at supportkuaf.com. Ahead, conversations with people who are on campus today or will be here tomorrow. That's just ahead. But right now, Christina Thomas.
Thank you, Kyle. Becca Martin Brown from Northwest Arkansas Newspapers is joining me now to tell me what's up for tomorrow.
Well, we're going to talk about music, which means I defer in spirit to Kevin Kinder, our assistant features editor and the person who knows all about music in Northwest Arkansas. He tells me to tell you that the Old Crow Medicine Show has been announced as an act coming up at the Arkansas Music Pavilion, and tickets are on sale. He describes them as neo-bluegrass.
I was going to say they're kind of folk.
Yeah.
I think.
As like I would know. Neo-bluegrass, he says, known for bridging the gap between old-time traditionals and new-wave Americana. They perform on May 5th, and tickets start at $32 at 443-5600. It's spring, so the patios are opening. Okay, they told us it was spring. Perhaps it really will be. And that means that Joe Giles and the Homewreckers are out and about. They play at Jose's in Fayetteville on Thursday nights, which is also bike night for the venue. And if you're on the road and looking for something strange and interesting, Mike Tyson is currently touring with a one-man show.
Like the Mike Tyson?
That's the one.
Okay.
Yeah, the boxer guy.
Not Tyson Chicken.
Okay. Directed by Spike Lee. He's already been in Vegas and New York City, and he performs in St. Louis on Friday at the Peabody Opera House. The show starts at 8 o'clock, and tickets start at $40. I haven't got a clue what this show is about, but if you want to know, try calling 800-745-3000.
Sounds interesting. Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. Back to you, Kyle.
Thank you, Christina. Remember, this is the spring fundraiser at KUAF. You can pledge at any time of day or night at supportkuaf.com. More about that in a little bit. Marcus Erickson cares deeply about oceans, waterways, and what pollution does to them. He's founded the organization Five Gyres Institute in Los Angeles, and tomorrow he'll speak on the University of Arkansas campus about his experiences with the garbage floating in the Pacific Ocean. I talked to him yesterday from his home in Los Angeles about his passion for the world's water.
I kind of always wanted to have a Huckleberry Finn kind of adventure. So it wasn't until, I think, long after I came back from the first Gulf War. I was a Marine back in 1991. And in a foxhole, I made a promise to another Marine, if we survived that war, that we would do that, that he and I together would raft the Mississippi. I couldn't find him 10 years later, but I did it myself. I built a raft, went to the top of the watershed in North Minnesota. It took 5 months to get down to my hometown. And along the way, I saw so much trash. It was unbelievable how much trash was leaving our nation's greatest watershed, heading out to sea, the sea that I, you know, fell in love with, you know, as a kid on the shores of the Gulf of Mexico. And at the same time, a few years around that time, I had an experience going out to Midway. And that's that island, as you know, midway between California and Japan. I went there to learn about American history and take some kids to study seabirds. And I saw hundreds of Laysan albatross skeleton. Every single one had a pile of plastic trash between its ribs. So I saw where it was coming from, or some of it, from the Mississippi. I saw where it was going and the impact it was having on their life. And I just felt I had to do something. So that began my sort of focus on plastics.
Well, let's go back to the Mississippi first, because you casually mentioned you built a raft. Well, you didn't just build a raft. You built a raft out of plastic bottles.
Yes. So I used, if you think about a raft, if I built a pontoon boat, I have a chance of one pontoon getting hit by a stick or a rock and busting and half my raft sinking. But plastic bottles, I use 232 2-liter plastic bottles. It's unsinkable. I mean, you've got to pop every single bottle to get my bottle rocket raft to sink. And that kept me afloat all the way down from Lake Itasca, Minnesota, 2,300 miles, to Venice, Louisiana, right before it pours out in the Gulf of Mexico. And it was just an amazing adventure.
Aren't there locks on the Mississippi River?
There are 27 locks and dams. And I locked through every one, and I had a very similar conversation with every lock master. First, the question from the lock master was, you know, what in the world are you doing? And second, we began talking about, you know, the Mississippi River and plastic trash and all the rafts that they had seen going by. I'm surprised how many people actually attempt to have that Huck Finn kind of adventure. And they would also tell me how much trash they see. Oh, yeah, I see, you know, 1,000 bottles a day. So I really got some inside scoop on how much trash is leaving our nation's waterways.
How much trash is leaving our nation's waterways?
I don't have a quantitative number to give you, but I mean, every day that I was on the river, I could look left or right and see, you know, piles of trash on the banks of the river. I even had a portlet, you know, race me down the river. I had milk crates. I had two houseboats. They were loose, floating right beside me. So there was all kinds of trash, big trash, small trash, and a never-ending trail of, like, styrofoam cups and plastic bottles, bottle caps, cups and straws and plastic bags, all the single-use, throwaway plastic that we use, you know, for a very short period of time, has a long life after we use it and lose it.
Now, just during your trip, you saw a lot of trash. The Mississippi is not the only waterway, obviously, in North America, and North America is not the only continent. Is there any way to describe how much plastic trash is floating into our oceans?
Well, to say how much is leaving our waterways worldwide is difficult to put a number on that. But if you go to some places where there is no waste management, where they have no infrastructure to deal with waste, to collect waste, and some countries have just been used to using natural packaging, banana leaves and vines and so forth, to carry and package their materials, they have this habit of throwing stuff on the ground. Because in their history, it's biodegraded. So if you go to, like, Manila, some parts of Malaysia, parts of Africa, South America, you can find waterways choked full of plastics. And it's not just those parts of the world as well. You know, I live here in Los Angeles now. When you get a heavy rain, you can watch all the trash, I mean, literally tons of it, going down the L.A. River. So it's a global problem.
And so we have these conglomerations, these sort of floating subcontinents, kind of a flotsam out there in the oceans, don't we?
Yes. So that's what I've done the last 10 years. My wife and I began an organization called the Five Gyres Institute. And a gyre is simply a floating mass of water. In the Northern Hemisphere, there's the North Pacific Gyre and the North Atlantic Gyre, and they occupy the entire ocean. It's just the way the atmosphere, the winds turn and move the currents. So it creates these giant vortex of currents. In the center, if you sail there, and I've been to all five in the world, you find not just like an island of trash. What you find is like a soup of plastic confetti. It's the best way to describe it. It's broken up small fragments. So out there, it's kind of really hard to solve the problem in the middle of nowhere when you got all this stuff. You can't recognize what product it is. So broken, and you really can't point to a country. What we're finding is, you know, there is all this trash out there, but the way to solve this is to stop adding more and go back up our waterways, back to the way we sort of look at the products we use and the way we manage the trash we produce.
When someone hears a conversation that you're having with someone like me on the radio, or they hear you when you speak at the University of Arkansas, what do you want them to take away? Not just the knowledge, but what sort of action would you like to generate?
I think the action is to become very much aware of the life cycle of trash. Our trash, it goes somewhere. And if we look at plastics, unlike metals, many metals are recyclable and have some value. And wood and paper will biodegrade. Glass is inert. But plastic has this very long life. It absorbs toxins, and it's non-biodegradable. It can transport around the world. So to decrease the use of single-use, throw-away plastic products will do the world a favor. And it isn't just, you can't point to one country. It is the slow loss, incremental loss of small plastics over decades has made these mountains of trash in the ocean. So everyone's effort really makes a difference.
Now, you grew up in Louisiana. That's a border state to Arkansas. I don't know if you've been on the University of Arkansas campus before, but if you've floated down the Mississippi, you've at least drifted by Arkansas before. Any experiences with this state before?
I did, actually. I had one of my best experiences on the Mississippi River was floating down, and I got to, I think it was Osceola. Mm-hmm. Osceola, if I sang it right?
Yeah, Osceola.
Osceola, Arkansas, and I remember I was really cold and tired, and I knew there was a landing coming up soon somewhere, and I hadn't seen one for a long time. And I remember floating by, and I can hear on the right bank, on the Arkansas side, I can hear a couple shotguns going off. So I pull my raft over, and I come climbing out of the river to see what's up. And I startled a few young people who were shooting bottles with a shotgun. And they said who I was, what I was up to, and we got to talking for a bit. And they said, oh, if you go just another mile, you'll see there's a landing, a boat ramp, and there's a park where you can camp. So I did just that. I went back on the river, back to my bottle rocket raft, got to the landing, pulled the raft, tied it up, pitched a tent, and just fell asleep. 9 o'clock at night, I see headlights, you know, shining right through the tent. And I throw on my boots and I go scramble out there, and it's the same three people. And they brought me, I mean, a heaping pile of turkey and cranberry sauce and stuffing and another plate full of different kinds of pie. It was Thanksgiving Day, and these three young people just saw a stranger, you know, coming through down the river, and they just offered this gift of kindness. I'll never forget that. That's my best memory. One of my best memories on the river was the kindness of strangers from Arkansas.
And I imagine that's just the sort of thing that can keep you going to complete that mission.
Yep, it gives you a wonderful confidence in people and of yourself. And that's killed me for a long time.
If people want to know more about Five Gyres, where can they go online?
If they go to fivegyres.org, it's a number 5, then G-Y-R-E-S, they can learn more there or just come see me at the University of Arkansas. I'll be there giving a talk this week.
Marcus Erickson, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Marcus Erickson will speak tomorrow on the University of Arkansas campus. The talk begins at 5:30 inside Giffels Auditorium in Old Main. The talk is free and is open to the public. I talked with him yesterday.
Professor Lee Lind of Dartmouth College, an internationally recognized expert in sustainable fuel production and related issues, delivered the 2013 address in the Winthrop Rockefeller Distinguished Lecture Series at the University of Arkansas this afternoon. He spoke on bioenergy, food, and the sustainable resource transition. I spoke with him before his talk. He began our conversation by saying that throughout history, an awful lot of things have been and are determined by a resource base for humanity.
And there was a time that human beings fed themselves, and their general activity during the day was hunting and gathering. And they would get food from a given area, and when that area was exhausted, they'd move on. And they didn't build permanent houses. So you can imagine what you valued and how you spent your time and what skills were important then versus now are completely different. And then there was this transition, which actually occurred over several millennia and isn't absolutely completely done now. There's still people that live in that mode, although not many. Prior to the Industrial Revolution, the vast majority of human beings spent most of their days producing food. That's what people did. Well, you know, now in the United States, about 2% of people are directly involved in producing food, and most of us do very different things.
Well, and the people that do produce food, it's kind of, most of it's on a large scale.
Sure. And in the United States, there's a lot of diversity in how food is produced worldwide. But yes, in the United States, most of the food is produced on very big farms by very few people. And the reason I mentioned these two prior resource transitions, or one might even use the term resource revolution, is that I think there's a lot of evidence that we're heading into a third or perhaps the third major resource revolution, in the sense that when we leave the century that we're in now, there are an awful lot of indications we will need to be supported by sustainable resources and be using those resources in a sustainable way, which is a somewhat separate matter. This is a big, big, big transition. In the past transitions, there were many local experiments, not all of which had to work from the point of view of the human enterprise moving on. It's a much more integrated world. Changes are happening much faster. We have 7 billion people.
And it keeps growing.
Yeah, and don't think the world is yet taking this seriously enough. And so I spend a lot of time telling people that I think there's an issue, but I think there are solutions.
Okay. What are some of the solutions?
It's a matter of learning to live off of income rather than capital, resource income rather than resource capital. And so look at the things we do today, whether it's energy use, which is a major factor in all of this, or for that matter, land use. And we have to, you know, use land in a way that it remains usable. You can't really do that with energy, but at least we have to use energy in a way that doesn't deplete our energy capital. That's really the common denominator to the solutions as I see it. My personal activity tends to be focused on issues that involve land. And what brought me to this field was the idea of producing fuels from plants you can't eat. But that has brought me to a broader set of issues because we're not going to decide to produce fuel without considering the other things we can do with land and need to do with land, by the way, to feed people and to provide wildlife habitat and ecosystem services and the like. So
then we have this land battling for two uses, I guess, for energy and for food.
There are multiple uses and expectations we have of land, and it's certainly possible they can battle, but part of my thesis is it's not necessary that they battle.
Okay. So your talk this afternoon is just that, bioenergy and food.
Yeah.
And, how the two are related?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there are many relations. I think the ones people are most familiar with are potential negative interactions between using land to produce energy and using land to produce food.
Well, meaning like corn and ethanol, or?
That's certainly a subject of criticism. We use about a third of the corn crop in the United States to produce ethanol at this point, and that provides something a little less, not a lot less, but a little less than 10% of our total gasoline. But I try to focus on win-win opportunities, if you will, and there's actually quite a few of them. For one thing, although the world's lands are rather fully occupied, they're not that fully utilized. And I've been looking particularly of late about pasture land. One curious thing about pasture land is that when the Food and Agricultural Organization, the FAO of the United Nations, classifies land, you know, forest land is land with trees, cropland is land with crops, deserts identifiable, tundras identifiable. And if you basically take the total land and subtract all those, what you have left is pasture.
So sort of, flat, not necessarily grassland, but...
Some of it's grassland, some of it's scrub. There's a huge diversity, but there's a lot of it. And there's a lot of evidence that globally, pasture land is not very fully utilized. In fact, only about 60% of it's occupied by animals to start with. And of that, there's a tremendous amount of it that is not managed close to its potential. Perennials are a wonderful way to keep surface waters from having nutrients enter them. They can actually be used to regenerate soil fertility and reclaim land. They add diversity to landscapes. Soil carbon storage is a possibility. Increased farm revenue. In this part of the country, I was learning this morning, you grow a lot of winter wheat. But in other parts of the United States and temperate regions around the world, the ground is not planted for a significant fraction of the year. There can be added farm revenue from introducing winter cover crops with all sorts of advantages. It's hard to see who loses in that, provided you have a market for these perennial grasses. I've also, I lead something called the Global Sustainable Bioenergy Project, and we think a lot about, interestingly, the two areas in the world that probably have the greatest potential to grow biomass are Africa and South America. A significant group of people are starting to think along the lines that bioenergy can help food security in the poor places of the world, although it's been regarded in the past as something that would hinder it.
Which the poorest places are Africa and South America.
Yeah, there's some poor people in Asia as well. But the highest incidence of poverty and highest incidence of food security or insecurity in the planet is in Africa.
But they just don't have the means and the knowledge to do so?
It's in a nutshell, it's a result of institutional failures. And there's a lot of different institutions that can share part of that responsibility. But it's a human-made problem as opposed to a geographically limited situation. And actually, for example, the way food aid is administered is a contributing factor to the perpetuation of food insecurity. Food aid is administered for the benefit of the producers, which is, after all, where the policies are made that determine how the food aid is dispensed. I'm not saying there's never a use for it. I'm not saying that there aren't many well-intentioned initiatives. But nevertheless, my understanding and the understanding of people who've looked at this more closely than I have is that food aid, the way food aid is administered, perpetuates food insecurity in Africa. The fundamental insight, I think, is all involuntarily hungry people are poor. The big reason people are food insecure in a place like Africa is the absence of economic development. It's not the absence of land. And so it might at first appear that, you're putting an added demand for land in a place where people are already starving. Isn't this a bad idea? But that kind of assumes that the land is limiting and that the jobs are not. It's actually the other way around. And so one has to be very careful about introducing an added demand for land. And one of the things my colleagues and I have suggested is, look, even on a local level, bioenergy should make food security better, not worse. So just put that as a constraint and move on.
Well, we were talking about corn and ethanol being not a great combination necessarily. And you mentioned that there are some good combinations. Can you elaborate a little bit?
Yeah, let me just comment quickly on corn and ethanol. There are arguments that if we did not have a corn ethanol industry, that we would either have many fewer farmers or we would have lower corn prices. That would be good for some people. Corn prices were low for a long, long, long time. Up until about 2005, corn was on the order of $2 a bushel. I haven't looked lately, but it's been in the 5 to 7 and 8 range. Mm-hmm. And it's not expected to go back down anytime soon. And so for all of that time when the corn prices were low, the idea of keeping rural communities in business and keeping farmers in business seemed like a great thing.
Corn farmers.
Well, when it was smaller, it wasn't having as much impact. You know, there are now people my son is a dairy farmer in Vermont.
And it makes feed.
And he's not happy about he and the other dairy farmers he knows in northern Vermont are not happy about what they're paying for corn. And
right, that's what I meant. It makes feed more expensive.
It certainly does. Yeah, hogs and poultry and all the rest of it. So corn is one of the easiest sources of readily fermentable plant matter, and that's why we make ethanol out of it. That's why it's the first thing biofuel we've done in this country. A significant factor over the decades that we've had a corn ethanol industry and that it's received governmental support of various kinds is increasing demand for things farmers know how to grow. There are other raw materials that can be used to make biofuels. And we can grow grasses, we can grow trees. Some people talk about growing algae, for example. Mm-hmm. All of this is photosynthesis. All of it, potentially, including corn, is ways to tap into our energy income. Because after all, this is a form of captured solar energy.
Which I believe there was a project at the university recently about using algae.
Yeah, yeah. You know, which of these raw materials, you know, will become the basis for, if any, for, you know, large-scale displacement of petroleum remains to be seen. A striking thing is, I don't know the local prices here, but if you look at, for example, what a paper mill pays for wood chips or what people pay for hay that doesn't have much protein in it, basically, in many parts of the country, $60 a ton is a round number. Turns out that's about $4 a gigajoule, so what? But that's equivalent to oil at about $25 a barrel. And so we're talking about a very cost-competitive raw material. And so why don't we do this now? Simple. We don't know enough about processing it. If we knew more about processing cellulosic biomass, the trees and the grasses and whatnot, we would be doing it. It's an interesting situation because photosynthesis has been on the Earth about 1.7 billion years, as far as we know. So then we want to process this stuff. And keep in mind, the purpose of a corn kernel, the biological purpose of a corn kernel, is to provide energy for the next generation. It's to make it through the winter.
Right, it's essentially a seed.
It is a seed.
Yeah.
At which time, its biological function is to be easy to take apart. So you've got this, you know, this little stirring life within the seed that needs to sort of commandeer these resources. You don't want those resources to be hard to mobilize, if you will. By contrast, the purpose of cellulosic biomass, the biological purpose, what it does for the plant, it's the structure. It holds it up. And therefore, it's evolved to be resistant to attack. And that is the origin of the technological challenge, that plants have evolved to be hard to take apart, and we're trying to take them apart. On the other hand, we don't need to get into the details, but I don't particularly think cellulosic biomass is inherently much harder to process than oil. It's just that we've been at it a lot less time. So I'm very optimistic that we'll be able to do this in time in a cost-effective way. And that's probably a good thing because, as anybody has noticed, the argument that we're going to be forced to find alternatives to fossil fuels because we're running out of them is getting harder to make. There may be other reasons that people would be concerned about mobilizing some of these resources. But you know, every time people think we may be running out of fossil resources, we seem to find more. And so there's this expression that the Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of stones. As we talk about this historical transition that needs to happen in the next century, or in this century, excuse me, in the next 100 years, I think we're going to have to rely on more than scarcity to drive us to do it, which makes it a bit more challenging.
Right. All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Lind.
You're welcome.
Dr. Lee Lind is a professor of Dartmouth College. He spoke this afternoon in the Winthrop Rockefeller Distinguished Lecture Series at the University of Arkansas.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Tahlequah, Oklahoma. I'm Kyle Kellums. My special thanks to my colleagues Antoinette Grajeda and Christina Thomas for helping me with this evening edition of Ozarks at Large. Don't forget, you can make a pledge to support KUAF during this spring fundraiser easily and simply. You can do it right now. We don't have phone volunteers here. They won't be back till 6 tomorrow morning, but you can go online to our website, supportkuaf.com. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Christina, Antoinette, and the rest of the Ozarks at Large crew will be back tomorrow at noon for a brand new edition, a fundraising edition of Ozarks at Large. Thanks to everyone who has contributed so far. Again, if you're thinking about it right now, you can use your smartphone app or go to supportkuaf.com. Have a very pleasant Tuesday evening. Try to stay dry. It's 8 o'clock.